This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So in this month, we have three questions. The first question from this week is from Nick Sanders, and he asks, I'm interested in matter falling into black holes. It has long been a problem for me to understand how matter ever crosses the event horizon. To an external observer, matter will never cross the event horizon, but just get closer and closer to it. To an observer falling into the black hole, and then he quotes, assuming they survive the spaghettification, which I quite liked, wouldn't the black hole evaporate before they ever close the horizon?
Yeah, yeah. So so it's a good question, actually. And I think probably what we should do is just remind people what a black hole is first, quickly. So it's basically an object where the force of gravity is so strong that as you approach it, the force of gravity is stronger and stronger and stronger. You get to a certain point where it's so strong that you couldn't possibly escape from it unless you were able to somehow travel faster than the speed of light. So obviously that's not possible. So basically, as you approach a black hole, there's a point or a, you know, point in space which you cross, which you can never get back out from. That's called the event horizon. What he actually mentions is this point about when we look at, if we were to look at something falling towards a black hole, then there's this effect called gravitational time dilation, which basically means the photons as the photons are coming away from this object as it's falling in, we see, because of this gravitational redshift effect, we see the object slowing down. So from our view, we see this thing getting slower and slower and slower. And actually, it takes an infinite amount of time for an object to reach the event horizon, as seen by an external observer, as seen by us. So yeah, things, as far as we'd be concerned, things wouldn't actually, we wouldn't see them cross the event horizon. Mm-hmm. They sort of slow right down and effectively freeze on the event horizon. As it happens, it's actually impossible for us to see the event horizon because the photons that are coming from that point are gravitationally redshifted to non-existence, effectively. They're stretched out so we could never see it. That effect, that gravitational time dilation effect, is real, first thing to say. I mean, it sounds like it could be just a mad idea, but actually clocks in a strong gravity field run slow. And the way the classic example of this in real life are GPS satellite navigation systems that you might have in your car, because the GPS satellites are orbiting the Earth, they're well much farther away from the Earth than we are, sitting here on its surface, so they're in a weaker gravity field. So clocks, the atomic clocks on board those satellites run fast because they're in a weaker gravity field. So they actually run faster by about, it's 47 microseconds per day.
Oh, wow.
So if you were to compare a clock here on Earth with the clock on the satellite, they're actually running faster by 47 microseconds every day. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's enough to ruin GPS if we didn't correct for it. Yeah. So it's a real effect. And yes, so that happens. We see this object slow down as it approaches the event horizon. But from the object's point of view,
yeah,
it goes straight through. So the object doesn't feel itself slow down and freeze on the event horizon. It's only viewed from our perspective.
Yeah.
So the object just goes straight through the event horizon. And actually, then once it's through that point, it inexorably reaches the singularity at the middle, assuming there's one there. So it goes straight into the middle of the black hole and that's it. There's no saving the actual object. So in that sense, it's not a problem. So from that perspective of something falling in, the black hole can't evaporate before you fall in. You will just go straight in. So there's no problem there. And there was a little, you said you liked spaghettification.
Yeah. So, I quite like that phrase.
You've heard of that, presumably?
I've heard it, yeah.
So this is this idea that people are stretched into spaghetti.
Exactly.
So it's basically a tidal effect.
Yeah.
So tides, what we call tidal forces, are basically the difference in the force of gravity across an object.
Yeah.
So for like the Earth and the Moon, it's the difference in the force of gravity from one side of the Moon to the other. One side of the Earth to the other due to the Moon. In the case of spaghettification, it's as you sort of imagine falling in feet first. The force of gravity at your feet from the black hole could be significantly bigger than it is at your head,
yeah,
and that would actually rip you apart. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that if you do the calculations, when that happens, depends on the size of the black hole, the mass of the black hole. So in some black holes, it could be that you'd actually get all the way through the event horizon before you get ripped apart.
Okay.
In other black holes, it could actually happen to you before you get near the event horizon. So it does depend.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Brilliant. Perfect. So the second question is from Peter Ellinger. And he says, since obtaining a new telescope, it hardly stopped raining here in Sheffield. I've almost forgotten what the moon and the stars look like. I've got to wondering what other observational techniques could I employ to do some observing while waiting for the clear skies to return. I came up with two options, which I liked advice on, please. So his option one is radar astronomy, and option two is radar imaging. And then he asks, will either of these work when it's raining? And what could I expect to get out of the kit by the way of images?
Yeah. Okay. So I sympathise.
Yeah.
He lives in Sheffield. The weather's not much better over here in Manchester. So, yeah. So radio astronomy in that sense is useful for when it's raining because we can do radio astronomy certainly went through the clouds. Otherwise, you know, Jodrell Bank, for example, wouldn't be here. We'd be in, you know, in some exotic place on the top of a high mountain above the clouds. And actually, in terms of how much it affects it, well, it depends on exactly which bit of the spectrum you're looking at. So at low frequencies, so long wavelengths, so maybe wavelengths of like 20 centimetres, which are ones that we typically observe at, we're okay. We can see through the cloud. As you go to the shorter and shorter wavelengths, or equivalently the higher and higher frequencies, then the water vapour in the atmosphere has more of an effect. So, yeah, you can get to a point where the rain kills you off. But sticking to the lower frequencies, the higher, longer wavelengths is helpful there. His options, he mentioned radar imaging. I think the answer to that is no. Definitely not. You can't do radar imaging as an amateur. And the reason is, basically, it's generally illegal to transmit radio waves at any significant power.
Okay.
So, of course, you know, loads of people use the radio spectrum. Our mobile phones transmit radio waves, of course, but they are very strictly regulated that they do it at a certain relatively weak level. And loads of people use the spectrum for other things. Radar, airport radar are quite strong transmitters. The military radar use things. Atmospheric radar, so looking at the weather.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these uses of the spectrum. They're all very strongly regulated. And if you wanted to do anything about transmitting radio waves, you'd have to get a license.
Okay.
You can do. You can get an amateur radio license, a radio ham, they call them. And again, you are limited to certain powers. Now, in terms of radar imaging, the equivalent in astronomy would be, say, what's done with, like, the Arecibo telescope. They have a really, really powerful radar. Of course, it's very carefully regulated. Can be dangerous, really. If you stood in the way of these things, it's microwave radio waves. They're not good for you, so you have to be very careful about how they're used. But they can basically send out these radar waves, radio signals, effectively bounce them off a planet like Venus, Mars or whatever, and map the surface of the planet by looking at the echoes they receive. But because you're bouncing it off something so far away, the power they need is high. And that's why you can't really do it as an amateur. The closest you can get is moon bounce, it's called. So radio hams, amateur radio people, do the sort of more advanced ones at least, try out this technique of transmitting a radio signal towards the moon, and they actually catch the echo, they get the bounce off the moon.
Wow.
And that's an interesting project to try.
Yeah.
But yeah, strongly regulated, so don't go building your own radio transmitter because you'll be, somebody will be coming around knocking on the door. The other option mentions radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And what I would do is I'll point towards, there's two good groups of amateurs that do amateur radio astronomy. There's something called SARA, S-A-R-A, the Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, which you'll find on the web. There's also the British Astronomical Association, the BAA, Radio Astronomy Group, who are quite active as well. And there are things you can do. And there's a range of things. They've got ideas for projects on their websites, and it goes all the way from, perhaps even just using a small satellite dish like you have for TV and being able to detect the sun. I mean, you can actually pick up the radio emission from the sun with a little satellite dish. And there's interesting bits of physics you can even do with that in terms of understanding the resolution of a radio telescope, for example. Yeah, and in terms of looking at things a bit more distant, there are some quite exciting things you can do with a dish maybe a few metres in diameter, so a bit bigger than you'd stick on the side of your house. But you can get one of those. You can have a receiver which basically does fast sampling, digitisation of the radio signal, and you can actually measure the hydrogen line, the radio emission coming from hydrogen atoms in space. You can actually see the spiral structure in the Milky Way, even with a small radio dish, and what is now relatively cheap electronics, you know, with a PC at the back end. So that's worth looking into. One of the other things you can do is meteor astronomy. So you can do you can look at basically what happens is you tune a radio receiver to the frequency of a over-the-horizon TV or radio broadcast. So somebody's producing a TV signal somewhere. You wouldn't be able to see it directly because it's around the world, over the horizon from you. But basically what happens is it goes up through the atmosphere, the signal they're broadcasting, and a meteor comes into the atmosphere. It leaves an ionized trail in the atmosphere, and you get a reflection off the trail.
Okay, cool.
So what you then receive is like a little echo, a little burst of this transmission. And so you can actually see meteors even when it's cloudy or even during the day, you know, when you wouldn't be able to see them visually. So that's a possibility. So loads of ideas on their website. And I think I would just say imaging. You mentioned imaging. Imaging in general is a bit of a challenge in radio astronomy. What you could try is using a single dish and scanning it. So measuring the strength of the signal in a given direction and doing a sort of raster scan across the sky, that would build up an image. If you wanted to do interferometric imaging, like we do with, say, Merlin or the VLA or something, that's pretty difficult to do as an amateur, I think, largely because of the way in which you have to combine the signals, and that requires really accurate timing. But perhaps not impossible, certainly worth looking into, but that would be, you know, at the extreme end.
Brilliant, cool. The third question is from Phil Thomas. He asks, how do potential exoplanet researchers discriminate between a sunspot on the local star and an orbiting exoplanet?
Yeah, okay, so this is, again, a really good question. This is about finding planets going around other stars, and one of the great techniques that's really probably the best example of which is the Kepler spacecraft at the moment. But there's also some good ground-based work done with WASP or Super WASP, for example. What you do is you look at a star, you measure its brightness, keep measuring its brightness, and look for a dip as a planet that's orbiting that star goes round and passes in between us and the star. It blocks a little bit of the starlight. You see a dip in the brightness. Now, the chances of that happening are low, because most planets probably wouldn't pass directly in front of their stars, for example. So what they actually do is they monitor many, many, many stars. I think in the case of Kepler, it's it's about 150,000.
Yeah.
Maybe more with Super WASP. I have feeling it's more than that. But anyway, look those projects up. So to see that, you have to monitor lots of stars, and then every now and again you'll see one of these dips. And the question was, how do you know it's a planet? How do you know it's not a sunspot on the star? Because a sunspot, obviously, big one, would be less bright than the rest of the star. So you would see the brightness dip as a sunspot sort of came into view. Yeah. And then it would go back up again as the sunspot perhaps went round onto the other side of the star as the star spun round. Well, there's a few ways you can tell the difference. One is that when they look for these dips, they look for several of them. So they're looking for at least three, I think, of these dips separated by an exact period, because the planet would orbit with a very particular period. And so you'd see a dip, and then one dip doesn't tell you much, really. Where you see another dip a little while later, separated by, you know, if it was the Earth, separated by a year. Even that you wouldn't be sure about. Wait another year, you see the third dip, then you go, oh, hang on, there's something. These three dips look very, you know, look very similar. They're separated by this exact period. You're then pretty sure there's a good chance that's a planet, because a sunspot, basically sunspots come and go. You know, you wouldn't get that exact period happening with a given sunspot. Plus, the dip that you see will tend to be much shorter for a planet than it is for a sunspot. So the length of the dip. Now, the reason is, if you think about the sun spins with a period of about a month. So if you imagine a sunspot sort of rotating into view, it's going to pass across the front face of the sun in certainly a week, maybe up to 2 weeks. And then it disappears around the other side for a few weeks. And then if it lasted long enough, it might come round again. But typically they come and go on shorter timescales. But it'll be there on the face of the sun for at least a week. It's 2 weeks. So the dip would last for a week or two, whereas the planet dip only lasts for a few hours. And then I think probably the clincher, really, and the way they would, you know, we really get more information about these planet transits, is you've got this planet transit, it's a really good candidate. What you can then do is look at the star with a spectrometer, get a spectrum of the star, and look for these Doppler shifts in the absorption lines of the star that tell you that the star is wobbling. And that wobble is what's caused by the orbiting planet. And so that would be a real clincher for saying that that was a planet. So it is a good question, but there are ways of distinguishing
them. Yeah, cool. Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much, Tim, and thank you all for sending the questions. And please send us more questions by all the usual routes.
Thanks. Speak to you again next month.